Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Real Gym Radio. I'm Danny Lurie, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is Sam Vecenie, NBA draft and college basketball expert for The Athletic and host of the excellent Game Theory podcast. And as you would expect, we go through the 2023 NBA draft to talk about Victor Wembanyama, big takeaways from the draft, how to watch Summer League. We end up talking about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar for a while because Kareem is awesome. Cam Whitmore slide, a little bit on 2024 class, and much more. This episode is brought to you by FanDuel. Sign up at FanDuel.com/Boston and get up to $200 in bonus bets. And episode runs well over an hour. I hope you enjoy it. Thanks so much for coming on.
Well, Danny, I know that we don't like to timestamp these, but I feel like it's important to do this. You know, it's the first night of Summer League here. July 3rd, I believe it is in the United States, July 4th here in Australia. And I don't know if you knew this, but Brandon Miller, he's just a terrible basketball player. That's what we learned tonight after having scouted him for, you know, many hours of high school tape, you know, probably watched all, you know, probably 30 of the 36 games he played at Alabama this year. You know, heard from all the scouts and teams that had him in, so two of them, how he looked in the pre-draft process, heard from a bunch of teams that interviewed him during the combine, you know, but this game proved that he's a bad basketball player. I don't know if you knew that. This single game at Summer League is, it's going to show that Brandon Miller, despite going second overall and being a consensus top five pick at the very least, he's bad at basketball, Danny. I don't know if you knew that.
Sounds right to me.
Yeah, sounds like people aren't overreacting on the internet or anything like that. It's normal. Guys, we need to chill about these first games of Summer League. Just take a step back off the ledge. Things are fine. Brandon Miller was playing with one of the lowest IQ basketball teams I've ever seen assembled in terms of feel for the game. Playing with Kai Jones, playing with James Bouknight, playing with, 19-year-old Nick Smith. These guys are very young and don't particularly have great feel for the game. Let's chill, maybe. Take a step back. It's all going to be fine. We're going to be good.
It takes so long to feel comfortable with evaluations. I wasn't able to watch that game today, though I will hopefully see Miller both on tape and in person relatively soon. Where I wanted to start with you, because you know the whole draft better than I do. You know, we'll talk about the guys that I scouted. But, you know, from your perspective, and, you know, now you've had a little over a week to ruminate on it, what do you think is the biggest story, the biggest dynamic coming out of the draft?
So, look, I know that you and I really like to find the under the radar storyline or the thing that maybe people aren't talking about, but I think we can't miss the forest for the trees on this. It's undeniably Victor Wembanyama going to San Antonio.
So missing it's the what, forest for the man who is the size of a tree and not sapling, like a full tree.
Yes, it's exactly right. I think that we, it's funny. So being over here doing a stream for the entire 4 hours of the first round, right? I think that sometimes we can get caught up in the dynamics of what's happening on TV and what's happening throughout what happens after pick number one happens, because that is the majority of the time, the lion's share of the time. When I talked to Andrew Schlecht and did the Athletic NBA show, shout out the Athletic NBA show, like the morning after the draft, Andrew was there. And the biggest thing that he noted to me just being in the room was just how this truly felt like a coronation event for Victor Wembanyama, and how he was far and away the thing that people in the room, like fans, media members, everything like that, cared about. So I think it is Victor Wembanyama. This is the Victor Wembanyama draft. Whether he becomes something great, like his pedigree and certainly his talent level and tools would indicate he likely will be, Or if he doesn't become great, that's a whole different thing. I think that it undeniably is, this is the Victor Wembanyama draft, and we can't lose sight of that in spite of the idea of us wanting to focus on other things.
It's a great point. I will note, I was in the room too. I 100% agree with Andrew. It really was the Wembanyama show. And I mean, even for me, I walked in, and as often happens when you have a press credential and nobody tells you where to go, you just get really lost. I ended up by the like red carpet of sorts, and I was like, oh, there's Victor Wembanyama, who, like, I mean, I saw him roughly a year ago in France, and, you know, watched him play and everything. And it's fun when there's somebody like that. And I also think that it is a reminder, as much as there have been at times those sales pitches of, oh, it's great, you know, if people can fall in love with an American college player. And it's like, no, yes, that can happen, of course. But incandescent talent is incandescent talent. It doesn't matter where it comes from. And Wembanyama is a fascination, a curiosity, someone who many people will see for the first time in person very soon and have seen on tape in kind of different capacities. I fully credit the NBA for how much they made his stuff available, including on the app and everything else. But there was a palpable excitement, and it was interesting because the only other time I covered the draft in person was in 2012, and that was the Anthony Davis draft. And yeah, it wasn't the same thing. And the other reason why I think you're extremely right about this is because we often focus on what is surprising, what is interesting. Oh, this team did a really bad job, this team did a really good job. Well, you get the number one pick in a draft like this, you know who you're taking. And so there isn't drama there. And there was drama immediately after there. But appreciating that when all is said and done with this class 20 plus years from now, whether he ends up being the best player from this class or not, this is the Victor Wembanyama draft. And I think it's important to emphasize that.
Right. And the other piece of it is that you kind of talked about the fact that the NBA showcased all of his games this year on their app. And look, I think there's been a lot of talk in recent years on some level about how, you know, the NBA, it emphasizes the wrong things. Like, God knows that Ethan Strauss, you know, our former colleague at The Athletic, loves to talk about the marketing of the NBA, right? And the way that the ratings are and things like that. And I think that there are things about Ethan's premises that are just bad across the board. But I do think that there is a bit of a case to be made that sometimes the NBA does emphasize the wrong thing. I think that in this case, the NBA deserves an immense amount of credit for getting Victor Wembanyama in front of as many fans, particularly young fans, that will grow to love him over the course of his NBA career, that will grow up with him as hopefully one of the shining lights of the NBA. I think that getting him in front of as many people like that as possible by putting his games on the app, by emphasizing his social highlights as much as they did from like the NBA account, from these massive, enormous social media like platforms that they have access to, I think the NBA did about as good of a job as they possibly could have getting people excited about this guy, because he truly is somebody worth being excited about. Like, my biggest fear coming into this year truly was that people would make the same contrived bullshit arguments that they did about Vic, that they did about Chet Holmgren coming in. Oh, he's too skinny. He's like the 7 foot tall guy. He's going to get pushed around. He's this, he's that. And Vic is a better prospect than Chet. I love Chet, but like Vic is just a different dude, right? But I heard precious little of that over the course of the draft cycle. And I think it's because the NBA got this guy in front of as many eyes as they did throughout the pre-draft process, which made it just really fucking hard to argue with at the end of the day.
I've criticized the NBA before that I think, and this is actually in many ways more their broadcast partners than the NBA themselves, though separating those two things out can be very complicated, that they've generally been a couple of years too late rather than too early with the best players. And basketball ensembles are great, but it is really about those stars. And I mean, part of that was for me in person, like the idea that Steph Curry broke on the scene as late as he did, considering how great he was in the years before that. And like, especially because the best players, whether they're the number one pick or they're the number 15, 15 pick like Giannis, it takes often a little bit of time for there to be that team success. And I think that the NBA, there have been times that they've tried to break that. I mean, with Zion, they tried to, and then he got hurt and he missed a bunch of time. And I'm happy that they weren't super gun shy about that, that they, you know, and also there's less, it's less owner, like less of an obligation if you do it on the app and some of the other things than if you're like putting 20 of their games on ESPN and TNT and he doesn't play in more than half of those. But that's the thing that I think they need to do, is especially when a player is unique, especially when someone is, the sales pitch is so easy. And I think with Wembanyama, it is. Like, he does things that no one his size has ever done before. And so with the, like, it goes back to conversations that I've had with various members of the media. And like, it's funny, I've at times I've compared it to a lot of different industries. And it's like, if you believe in your product, whatever that product is, whether it's, you know, you built a better mousetrap, or you have a really good band, or you have a really good basketball player, your fundamental goal is to get it in front of as many eyeballs as possible and let them fall in love. The thing sells itself, especially with an entertainment product, and that's why I often talk about basketball in entertainment product terms, is because that's what it really is. And so kudos to the NBA for doing that. I hope that the broadcast partners continue to. It certainly seems like that will happen with Summer League, and I presume it will happen with the regular season as well. And my other hope now is that I get a little greedy now. It's like, okay, now do this with some of the other young guys too. You know, it's looking a lot more like Scoot Henderson and Brandon Miller are going to have real roles at the start of their careers. That doesn't mean you need to be setting these expectations like these guys are going to set the world on fire, they're going to be the best player in the league right now. But I personally, even in sports that I care less about, I love the journey. And I hope that the people involved can not only sell the journey, but sell that the idea that this is a process, and the idea that even the best don't start out as the best, except for Kareem, because he's just a monster. But other than that, like, it takes some time. And that doesn't mean they're bad, just as you brought up with Brandon Miller in the Open. But it does mean that these steps are worth watching and appreciating too.
Yeah, I do just want to bring up, like, the thing that drove me crazy among all of the conversations about Victor Wembanyama being the best prospect, like, in NBA history, better than LeBron, etc. Kareem is, like, definitely the best prospect in NBA history, right?
Absolutely.
Like, it's just, like, not debatable. Like, he entered the NBA and was MVP in year two and, like, was all NBA in year one, if I remember correctly.
And, like, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, back when he was Lew Alcindor, like, would have been the number one pick every, like, I know people who saw him at Power Memorial in high school, and he would have been the number one pick every single year had he been eligible. Like, he would have been, and then, and you know how he followed up being there, like, theoretically, he would have been the number one pick if he'd gone to high school? He followed that up by not being able to play in college, but still being the best player in college basketball. And then he followed that up by being the best player in college basketball. They followed that up by being the best player in college basketball ever. And so, yeah, I mean, it feels almost impossible to have a better resume than Kareem Abdul-Jabbar did before he entered the NBA, and even at any point before he entered the NBA.
Yeah, Kareem, in his first year at UCLA, which, for people who don't know, was a sophomore year, averaged 29 and 16. He averaged 26 and 17, and then 24 and 15 in his senior year. You look at what UCLA did in those years, it is just bonkers.
Well, do you know they won all
but one game, right?
Dude, the funnier one to me is, and you get a lot of this when you go to UCLA, is freshmen weren't allowed to play when Lew Alcindor went to UCLA. And so they played the freshman team against the varsity team, and the freshman team beat them because of Alcindor. That varsity team won the championship that year, and I think they only lost, like, a couple of games. And, like, yeah, and they lost crazy to just the freshman. Like, that's how good he was. And on top of it, they
had to change the rules of college basketball because of Kareem. Like, you could not dunk in college basketball for, what was it? It was like a decade or something like that?
Yeah,
because he was so good. Like, he was too dominant. They had to change the rules to outlaw the dunk because of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. It's, like, undeniable that he is the best prospect of all time, I think. LeBron is amazing, but, like, it's Kareem.
It's Kareem. It's always been Kareem. And the other thing, and when LeBron's basketball career is over, the biggest thing that will resonate with me, because he's the player who made me fall in love with basketball, in all honesty, and it's been so weird to cover him, including interviewing him personally, when that is the connection that I have with him, and we're the same age and everything else, is LeBron, the story for me is that he was the most hyped player of my lifetime, and he completely lived up to it. Like, I wasn't around for the MJ hype. I wasn't around for the Kareem hype. Kareem did that too. And, like, that is a story that is so fortunate. It may not happen with Victor Wembanyama. I hope it does more than almost anything. But basketball fans getting those, you know, like when you get that generational guy, and it's been to some extent true in other sports. I mean, my dad talks a little bit about Gretzky, but it's so cool when that happens, that it's not only like, oh, there's this special, like this is the best guy of 20 years or whatever, and then they do it. Then they live up to everything, yeah. Multi-time champion, like unquestionably one of the best of all time. Each of them has their own case, depending on how we want to define it. I mean, I would say they have the two greatest NBA careers in history, and that's just the way things go.
Yeah, like for me, like growing up in Pittsburgh, right? Like it's Mario Lemieux,
sure,
right? Like Lemieux got drafted by the Penguins, I think 5 or 6 years before I was born, something like that. So I get to see, like, as I'm, you know, 4, 5, 6 years old, growing up, like Lemieux just like being utterly dominant. Like I remember like some of my most like formative, like, you know, hockey memories of like being super, super young, right? It's just like watching Mario Lemieux just like tool on people when I was like 6 years old, right? Like in 1996. Like I think that was the year that like he scored like 70 goals or some shit. Like those are like, and he was another one that went number one overall, was like a 6'5", like enormous behemoth center that could do what he could do with his hands and could do, you know, everything that he needed to with the puck. Like he averaged like 2 points per game throughout his career, like just a bonkers number. And it's like him and Lemieux like are right there. And, you know, unfortunately Lemieux ends up getting cancer and, you know, ends up, you know, having to stop playing hockey when he's 32 basically, or 33, whatever, 31, whatever it was. And then he comes back and like the first game back, this dude like scores like a goal. And then like within the first 5 games back, he scores off of a goddamn face off. Like the whole thing is just crazy. These like transcendent talents. And to bring this all back to the original point of the conversation, what I see from Victor Wembanyama is a lot of transcendent stuff. Like he does, like, do you know when you watch players and you go, oh, that's novel, I'm not sure I've seen that before? Victor Wembanyama does things that like my brain can't really compute.
I mean, he got a tip, like, dunk on his own three-pointer.
Yeah, or like he takes like pull-up runner three-pointers, right? Where it's just like he's literally like off the bounce, takes one dribble forward, plants with his left, has the right leg in the air, like it's almost like a freaking Dirk fadeaway from the mid-range, and he's taking these shots from three. It's 7'4" without shoes on, and it's just like, what am I watching?
By the way, one other, since we're talking about ridiculous prospects, one other story I've heard recently, I have not independently verified this, is do you know why players have to stand behind the free throw line when they take free throws?
No.
Because Wilt Chamberlain used to dunk them.
That feels not possible.
I mean, he would do it with a running start, but like, that's the reason that they did it. And it's just like, there's that narrow group of people that just bend everything. And I mean, it also does make it a more equitable thing, though, if you just had guys taking free throw line dunks. Maybe you allow it like just in the last 2 minutes of a game, but also if you allowed Giannis to like get a layup, like he would get a layup if not a dunk, like that's, but it's, anyway, I just wanted to get in that, to jump back into it. And we appreciate Wembanyama. We also did an extended conversation about him previously. You and I believe both had Scoot Henderson number two. And even though this is not the time.
Yeah, wait, time out. What did your board end up looking like?
Sure. Wembanyama in a tier by himself, as you did. I think you called it the zero tier or the Wembanyama tier.
I called it Vic tier. Yeah.
Vic tier. I had Scoot number two in a tier by himself.
Then also what I had.
Then I had Amen Thompson and Brandon Miller together, Amen over. But again, if they're in the same tier, it's close. And then after that, I'd have to probably look, but it was Asar and more of the group. We only really got to 10 guys, but it was more of them together. And then the person of the people we did a real scout on that I liked the least was Anthony Black, and we can talk about why that was, though I still liked him. Like, you know, this, I like this class quite a bit. But I think I disagreed more, like my board seemed to differ with based on, you know, like compared to everybody else, higher on Taylor Hendricks, higher on, probably to higher on Asar Thompson, because I had him fifth. and then, you know, having Scoot well over Brendan Miller and Amen. So I guess it's probably that, and then Black being a little bit lower. I also really liked Grady Dick. I was impressed with him. You know, I wish I had the full context of, like, watching 20 dudes to see where I would have had him, but I liked him quite a bit.
Yeah, no, I think that's, like, all completely reasonable. I mean, for people who don't know, I ended up with Vic in a tier by himself, Scoot in a tier by himself. I had Cam Whitmore at 3 before I knew about the medical stuff. If I'd known about the medical stuff, I probably would drop him to 5 mm-hmm. and then would have had Miller and Amen in a tier and then had Whitmore at 5. I think the NBA, like, drastically overreacted to everything about Cam Whitmore, like, in a real substantial way. I'd have to think about it more with Cam. I do just, like, kind of buy him more than I buy Brandon Miller on some level. And the medical, from what I've heard, is not as bad as, like, what was indicated. I don't know. I'd have to think about it more. Truly, I would have to think about it more with Cam as to where I would rank him. There is a chance I would still rank him ahead of Brandon Miller.
It's funny. I'm ludicrously excited to see Cam Whitmore in person, but but in this class, just because of some of the unusual prospects in it, he's, like, I don't know, fifth or eighth on my list, because he's not going to be above Vic, he's not going to be above Scoot, he's not going to be above the Thompson twins. Like, it's going to be so much fun. Oh my god.
No, I'm, like, truly really excited to see the Thompson twins play, like, real, like, basketball. Not to denigrate Overtime Elite, I think the program is fine. It's just that they were so able to dictate, like, tempo and pace of play in overtime that it was really, really difficult, I think, at times to get a great feel for what their half court, like, overall offensive game looks like. And I don't know that, you know, truly any NBA scout, like, had a great vibe on that yet. The more you watch them, I felt better about it with Amen, which is why I had Amen in that tier that you referred to earlier. But I'm, like, truly intrigued to see what they look like on an NBA court with NBA spacing, hopefully, you know, maybe not in Detroit's case. But, like, I think that there's a lot to be excited about in regard to them, but more in regard to just, like, seeing them play. Like, I really am desperate to see them play on some level.
I also, and I mean, you and I talked about them a fair amount earlier on, I think it was in this space, not on your show, and the idea of just where their athleticism fits in the NBA. Like, I think they're both ridiculous. Yeah. I think Amen is one of the better athletic prospects I've ever seen. But is it apparent immediately? Is it like the grabs the Mario star and just kind of flies through everything? If it's like that, again, in a week or whatever, when I see him, it's going to be like, okay, well, then there's some thing, you know, like, that doesn't mean everything.
Totally.
and so that's going to be really fun. And you get, like, I think it's very tempting to overreact to summer league, especially the things that players adjust on in time, like getting stronger and the athleticism jumps and everything else. But there are certain elements, for better and for worse, and the way I've long described this is, like, every year at summer league, and since I'm only going to be there for one full day, it probably won't be this year, I have at least one guy, like, who I see in person who I'm just like, how did this guy not get drafted in the first round? And then at least one guy where I'm like, how did this guy get drafted in the first round? And it's those basic pops or non-pops that are really interesting and potentially, in the positive case, really exciting.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely a really great way to put it. I would be very interested to see who you think your predictions are for how did this guy get drafted in the first round and how did this guy not get drafted in the first round. But yeah, I guess you haven't watched enough, like, high-end tape yet.
Right, exactly. No,
guys.
And that's kind of the fun.
So that's
part. So, like,
almost
for me, last
more fun. Yeah.
The guy, we didn't get to Johnny Davis, and I saw him the first time, I'm like, And then for me, the guy last year the other way was Josh Minot, who I'm like, oh, I'm not saying he's definitely going to pop, but it's like a guy with this athleticism and this size, like, you roll those dice.
Yeah, I'm a little bit lower on Minot from a skill perspective.
Sure. That's completely fair.
Like, but I think, like, the way I think about it often is a little bit different than how, like, many think about it. I think about it from the perspective of what value is this player going to give to the team that selects him? Point blank. That can be on the trade market. That can be with his play. It can be, you can take it any number of different directions. But it's why, like, I had GG Jackson as a second round pick. I would be stunned if GG Jackson brings real value to the team that took him first, right? I absolutely think GG Jackson has an immense amount of talent. I just also think that he seems to be very immature. He is somebody that doesn't really see the court well yet in terms of passing, in terms of defense, in terms of his overall feel for the game. But I think that by the time he's 22, 23 years old, he's probably going to be pretty good. It's just the problem is that he's coming into the NBA at 18 years old. And that's 4 years of not getting any value out of somebody. It's exactly what happened with Talen Horton Tucker with the Lakers. And frankly, Talen Horton Tucker went as good as it possibly could have gone for the Lakers. He still did not provide much in terms of actual on-court value to winning basketball. And then they moved him for Patrick Beverley, who also did not provide much value for the Lakers, who then got moved for Mo Bamba along with like a pick, or you know, maybe they got a pick back. I can't remember. Like, they end up in a circumstance where even though they seemingly nailed the Talen Horton Tucker pick across the board, he's so young that they didn't really get any value for him by selecting him where they selected him. And that's the risk you run. And it's why in the second round, I do like taking flyers on older players, and why I feel a little bit better about that, because I feel like I can get a lot of the younger high upside swings on the second go around, or as our friend Kevin Pelton calls it, the second draft.
Mm-hmm. It's a great point. I want to transition to Portland, because I, especially as I got through the film on Scoot Henderson and thought of him as one of the, you know, like one of the better prospects in recent years. Like, I mean, if Wembanyama was in the draft, he would have been number one, but I think he would have been number one in plenty of other years. I haven't like rated him contextually the same way Nate and I did with Victor, because, you know, that seems silly to do with the number two pick. But it got into this interesting place, and it also made it so funny that he ended up going, you know, not second, but third. Is the challenge, if let's say Portland, who of course has our mutual friend Mike Schmitz in their front office, if Portland evaluated him the same way, or even similarly to what we both had of having him in a tier by himself and everything else, you get the idea of why, even if they felt pressure to get better right now to appease Damian Lillard, who of course has since requested a trade, why you wouldn't want to mess with that. Because A, those kinds of trades are very rare, and you're probably, even if the, you know, there's a wider variance for Scoot Henderson than for most established commodities, because, you know, he hasn't played in the NBA. There's a lot we haven't seen, and his last year in the G League night was a little bit different. But I can imagine them just like, you know, having preliminary calls and just being like, oh, this isn't even close to as good, especially when you consider the salary structure and cost control and all that.
It's seriously, like, if you were them, would you actually take Brandon Miller? Like, think about, like, Brandon Ingram, let's go with, right? I think Brandon Ingram's awesome. I can't remember if you're someone who thinks Brandon Miller's a little bit better, a little bit worse, because everybody seems to be pretty polarized.
Wait,
on
Miller,
Brandon Ingram.
Miller or Ingram? I'm confusing
Ingram,
Brandon's
Ingram,
here.
Ingram.
Ingram, okay.
Yeah. The one who's like already an all-star, right?
Yes.
I think Brandon Ingram's like awesome, and I think he's going to keep getting better. And I think he's somebody whose game like really profiles well toward being like a mismatch hunter in the playoffs. And we've seen it like on some level, like a, you know, very brief glimpses in that 6-game series, you know, last year, where he averaged like 27-6-6 or whatever it was for New Orleans in that series. Where, who did they push? Did they push, was it Memphis, if I remember correctly, or was it the Warriors? It was Phoenix. Yeah. Because it was, I remember they were the 8th seed. And he was like incredible in that series. And he followed it up this year with like his best year of his career, right? And I think Brandon Ingram is awesome. The problem is Brandon Ingram has 2 years of team control. So even if you're acquiring him to play with Damian Lillard, I don't know if you can win in the next 2 years with an Ingram-Lillard combo. And then at that point, you risk Damian Lillard aging out once you get into his age 35 year. So like, even though Brandon Ingram, I think, is probably going to be a top, by the time he's 28, I think he's probably going to be a top 10 to 12 player in the league, something like that. I still can't really get to the point where I am moving the number 3 overall pick being Scoot Henderson for Brandon Ingram. I just can't, because the team controls too much.
And because the ceiling is high enough to justify it. And I'm lower on Ingram than you, not dramatically so, but I am lower. Like his place as the best player on a great team is always going to be a little bit of a challenge, but it's always worth remembering young players, their games grow and expand, and he can reach a higher level. He's continued to improve. I like Ingram a lot, but that's the exact point. Is now, if Zion becomes available for that, then you're getting into the like health bet versus everything else, and things get a little bit more complicated. But that was the conclusion that I came to when I was kind of thinking about, well, what do you do here? Is you're, even if, and Scoot Henderson is far from a sure thing, just like basically every player who has ever been drafted, you, in some ways, what the draft is about, especially at the top, is that All-NBA and ideally MVP equity. And because it is so hard to get those players any other way. You can do it. Many, many teams have. Maybe it's a trade, maybe it's something else. But when you look through the, like, the annals of, like, best players on title teams or even best players in NBA finals, like, they're hard to come by. And some of them have changed teams more, like Jimmy Butler, but usually they haven't. And so you kind of have to stick with those. And if you think that this player could fit that bill, it'd be very hard to pull them away. And the other thing is, if that's what you're willing to trade that pick for, other teams aren't willing to trade guys they think have that potential either, for the exact same reason.
Yep. No, it's absolutely right. It really is, like, truly right. And it's truly, that's why it was so difficult to find, like, a trade that made sense for number three. The only name I heard, and I don't know if New Orleans is willing to do this, was Zion, because you can sell yourself on Zion, who is under team control for four more years, like, being a dude. Like, he could be the best player on a title team at some point. The problem is that Zion's floor is also playing 30 games a season for the next 3 years, and you getting, like, no value out of him, essentially. You're getting, you know, a third of the value that you were hoping to get out of him over the course of the next 3 years. So you also really struggle to do that, I think. It's why it never made sense for Portland, as long as Scoot Henderson was there, to trade the pick. Now, if it was Brandon Miller there, all bets are off. I had Brandon a little bit lower than I had Scoot. I think Brandon's going to be, like, a really good basketball player. I don't think he has the upside that Scoot does. So, you know, that's when it gets a little bit more interesting. But then if you're the Pelicans, it also becomes less interesting for you, because you don't want to move Brandon Ingram for Brandon Miller, because your best hope is that Brandon Miller can become a Brandon Ingram-like player. So, like, it's hard. It's truly, truly difficult.
I don't think that's the reason Damian Lillard will likely end up in a different team's uniform at some point in the next few weeks or months or days. We'll have to see. But I am very sympathetic. And so the idea that even if you wanted to, and you could argue that that's, you know, Portland moving up in the draft was both a great thing for them in a lot of ways, but also it kind of accelerated this departure because you weren't presented with any other reasonable choice. And
yeah.
I hope that Brandon Miller, like, you know, and we're both wrong on these things a fair amount. You know, it's always hard prediction. But, like, the way I've thought about it for a while and is that, as the Hornets here, if it kind of seems like everyone else is trading up for somebody, maybe you should seriously consider taking them. You know, like, the idea of, like, oh man, everybody's trying to do this, and no, we're not going to do that. We're going to take this other guy. And you have to be so confident in your board, so confident in your evaluation. And that doesn't make it the wrong pick necessarily. In hindsight, we'll prove it, but it does make it the wrong pick in my eyes right now.
Well, the better the example of that going the other way is, like, Boston deciding that Jason Tatum was their guy in that draft.
Yeah.
Like, they did genuinely have Jason Tatum ranked number one in that draft, in a draft where literally every other team in the league probably had Markelle Fultz at number one. If, you know, maybe there were 27 out of 30 teams that have Markelle Fultz at number one. So it does happen where that team ends up being right. Like, truly, it happens fairly regularly where it ends up that team ends up being correct. It's just very, very difficult, I think, to come up, for me at least, with the case for Miller athletically against Scoot. I guess that the way it was presented was always so strange that, like, it felt like to me a lot of media people presented it as if teams were moving up in this draft, they would be moving up for Brandon Miller. That is not the impression I got at all. Just genuinely, it's not the impression I got at all. There might have been a couple of teams that would have moved up for Brandon Miller. And there were teams that had Brandon Miller outside of the Hornets ranked ahead of Scoot Henderson. It was a genuine conversation for a lot of teams that I spoke to, in a way that it wasn't for me and you. Like, me and you just had Scoot at number two by evaluating both of them and deciding that we thought Scoot was the better prospect. I struggle to see how you get there outside of, like, the positional archetype. We're all very excited about, and God knows, Danny, you and I have talked more about these freaking, like, big 6'8" shot creating wings probably than anybody else on planet Earth in the hours we've spent on this podcast together, right? Like these are the things that you and I have talked about from an archetypal perspective. Here's the problem. They're valuable from archetypal perspective in terms of lineup versatility. You can get lineup versatility from like starting level, borderline all-star level players. The important thing in the NBA is getting the dude, just getting the guy at the end of the day. You have to get the player who can lead you to a title. If you look at the players across the board who have led teams to a title over the course of the last, let's call it, I don't know, last few years, let's say. So Jason Tatum, you know, led Boston to the finals, you know, a couple of years ago against they played the Warriors. Jason Tatum is an example of one of these like predator wings, right? He lost to a great guard as the all-time player in Stephen Curry this season. The Miami Heat get there with one of these predator wings like Jimmy Butler. Great. You can win with these guys. We're not saying you can't win with these guys. He lost to an all-time big in Nikola Jokic. Phoenix Suns, they get there with Devin Booker and Mikal Bridges and Chris Paul and DeAndre Ayton. Great. They lose to an all-time big in Giannis Antetokounmpo. You need to find the greatness first is my point in all of this. You can go back. You can say Kawhi Leonard. He won a title with Toronto. He beat the Warriors, right? That's great. Kawhi Leonard personifies the greatness that we're talking about here. But it doesn't have to be a wing. It can be a wing. It can be your Michael Jordan. It can be Kawhi Leonard. It can be, at some point, I think it will be Jason Tatum. I think he will lead Boston to a title. But it doesn't have to be that guy. You can get the greatness anywhere that you want, but you have to find the greatness first. And you have to take the informed bet on what the greatness is. And to me, Scoot Henderson has a higher upside chance of being great than what Brandon Miller does at the end of the day.
That also is, to a degree, how I ended up with the men over Miller, though they were in the same tier, is the idea, like, Brandon Miller's expected value is higher. Like, there is, and his bust potential is lower. Like, there is a chance that Amen Thompson's game just doesn't work. And that's not as much about the competition he faces, just because the track record of on-ball players who have an unreliable jump shot is flawed. And there are plenty of high-profile and low-profile examples of that. However, I like to think about, with a lot of these players, the, like, if it works, and what is the chance that it works? And the reason I ended up with Amen over Brandon Miller was the if it works with him is wild. Like, it's the, you know, on-ball force, could also be a very good defender. And, like, I think his jump shot is pretty bad right now, but it's not, like, unsavable. There are very few players where I would ever say that. He's so young and talented in many other ways, so you could, you know, put some developmental time into that. And it sounds like they're good kids that work hard, both Thompson twins. So it also, you brought up the idea, and it's so interesting with Ingram and Tatum, two big wings that we've invoked in this podcast, is like, neither one of them is like a superlative athlete either, but I think of Miller as kind of a step down from either of them. And
I do too.
It's also hard to become that player. It's easy to become, easy, it's doable to become a high-level support player without that. I mean, we've seen plenty of them. I love Chris Middleton. Like, Chris Middleton's, and he has, like, strengths in his own ways. But you have guys like Middleton, and plenty of other really good ones. He's just the one that came to mind. But the runway to being like that, the dude, is extremely narrow without that, and generally it requires an incredible skill level. Like, we could say what Kevin Durant does, when Kevin Durant's measurements and all that are ludicrous, and he's also one of the best jump shooters of all time, on ball players, everything else. So it's like, it's possible. It's just a hard road to go. And so it is completely reasonable to think that Miller is going to be better, and that especially with that higher floor because of his jump shot. And like, as Nate put it, like, guys his size who can dribble, pass, and shoot are extremely rare and thus extremely valuable. But there's a certain part where it's the All-NBA MVP equity, and I will lean more heavily on that. And that's a part of why Houston's draft is so tantalizing. And I'm sure, as you're a bigger Cam Whitmore believer than I am, like, to be able to get a guy with a real ceiling at four, and that he fell, which is less of a story than Scoot Henderson falling to three, but still potentially significant. We'll know a lot more in a year, in a week, all that stuff. But also getting Cam Whitmore to fall, and however it happened, and hopefully the things that led to him falling do not sidetrack Cam Whitmore's career. I hope that your interpretation of it is correct. But that's a lot of upside. That's a lot of talent, and the possibility of getting two potential starters, each of whom has some real upside, in the same draft, especially that have wing size, is not unprecedented, but extremely unusual.
Well, and I can kind of jump into the why on Whitmore. It wasn't just one thing. It was it was an accumulation of things. So I talked to 8 teams about this before the draft in terms of the medical, because I wanted to have like as good of a feel on the medical as I could. The impression I got was that it is a concern, like long term, not a short term concern. I'm trying to think of the right words here. A large majority of the teams that I talked to did not have him red flagged. They had it as like a yellow on his like draft profile, right? It's like, you know, I heard anywhere from could start to see some impacts, you know, at the end of his rookie deal, to this is a 10-year down the road kind of thing. And most teams were in the boat of thinking like this is like eight plus years down the road is when it'll really start to impact him in terms of the long term. To me, I don't, if you're talking 8 years down the road, if I'm an evaluator, like I don't care. I'm probably not going to be here in 8 years. Give me the guy that's good at basketball for the next 8 years. You know what I mean? Additionally, I'll follow up with this in a minute, maybe on the medical side. The other piece of it was Whitmore's like kind of a low key guy from everything I know. Very confident, very like he's not a bad kid, I guess is what I would say. Like he is just low key, confident, and he doesn't fill the room with energy like in pre-draft workouts. Like there were a couple of teams that told me like, you know, you kind of have to get him going. You kind of have like, you know, what is his motivation level like, stuff like that. I think everything that I heard was this is an 18-year-old and people are way overthinking this. People are truly way overthinking this. Nobody called him a bad kid. Like nobody said that, you know, this is a dude that is going to be a problem in the locker room. They were just like, this is a kid that like, you know, didn't work out super well when we had him into our building. I talked to a couple of teams where he worked out really well for them. But it was hit or miss in terms of the workouts. You know, Ryan Russillo noted on the Simmons podcast that, you know, the intel trickling down to teams from like the Villanova coaching staff wasn't great. I'll refrain from comment on that. It's just a number of different things, right? It's a number of different factors that the box gets ticked in your profile and you're like, well, okay, I guess that we can just remove him from consideration. There's too many things here, right? And in reality, I think all of them are explainable. Like, what if, like, look, I don't know this. What if he just didn't vibe with the coaching staff, right? Like, what if, like, that's where the motivation, you know, questions came from for some reason, right? If we're talking, like, the medical, you look through history, right? Malcolm Brogdon had a medical concern. That's why he fell to the second round. Like, rookie of the year in 2017, 1/6 man of the year this year. Like, we're 7 years into his career. He does miss some games. There are some medical concerns, like, where he'll miss 15, 20 games a year. Don't care. When he's on the court, he's really good. Michael Porter Jr. had what our good friend John Hollinger called literally the worst medicals he's ever seen in a prospect back in 2018. Just the third scoring option on a title team this year, making max level money. Robert Williams was flagged. You know, he made all defense. He misses games, but you know, when he's on the court, really good basketball player. OG Anunoby's medicals dropped into 23 after he tore his ACL at Indiana. Literally every team in the NBA wants OG Anunoby right now.
Yeah.
Right. I believe Cam Johnson was one that was flagged. He just got paid $100 million. Like you can go through history on these guys and teams just drastically overthink these things. And at the end of the day, I just want the guy that I know can play basketball. And you can have a different take on Cam Whitmore's basketball playing ability. You can't have a different enough take to where he falls to 20 on a talent basis. Truly. Like that guy is going to enter the NBA as one of the 15 best athletes in the NBA. Like you feel that way, right?
So we're talking about top 15 athlete?
Like power, explosiveness, physicality, like the intersection of those things in terms of like his athleticism, he will be a top 15 athlete from day one in the NBA. Maybe it trickles down a little bit earlier in his career where he goes from like 100% of his athleticism to 97% to 93% to, you know, 92% to 88%, like maybe a little bit earlier if you want to have a uncharitable feeling about his medicals. But, you know, I don't know that that's true. I'm just speculating on that like entirely. So, and I think NBA teams would be as well, by the way. So I just look at it and I'm just like, you can't let this guy get to 20. It is completely crazy to me that some of these guys that got taken over Cam Whitmore from a talent perspective, truly. Like, Cam Whitmore is really good at basketball. Even if you have him at 9 on your board, I did not hear anything from an intel perspective that makes me go, this guy needs to fall out of the top 12.
Sure, and it could be a circumstance. This is what happened from what people say with Michael Porter Jr., is that once you fall below the group of teams that seriously scouted you, they get a little spooked, because it's not only like they don't necessarily have the intel, but they're like, well, all these other teams did that. And so that can lead to these more precipitous falls happens in the NFL as well. So, but at a certain point, you just kind of need to make the bet. And I'm guessing we will, I haven't scouted everybody else, but like, I'm betting that there will be teams that regret it. At some point, I want to transition in some of the time we have left to, you know this draft so well, you know every draft so well, some players and their teams that you think of as unusually good fits. Like, oh, I'm so happy player X ended up with team Y.
Yeah. How about this? I was like very low on Brandon Pajemski throughout the process. Like, I think he's really going to struggle to defend in the NBA. And like, I don't think his athleticism in terms of its functionality on a basketball court is nearly like what the testing is. God damn it. Did he find the perfect spot for him with Golden State? Like, the basketball IQ, the shooting, the toughness, like the competitiveness that he has, the physicality that he's like totally unafraid of. He's going to be a good fit there. Like, I think he's going to be a rotation player by year two for Golden State. I really do.
He seems like a guy that Kerr is going to love.
Totally. Like, you couldn't find a better coach for Brandon Pajemski than Steve Kerr. Like, that is probably the one that stands out. I really like Derek Lively to Dallas. I think that is a perfect fit. He's going to get fed by Luka Doncic and Kyrie Irving over the next few years. He's going to be an incredibly versatile, impactful, effective rim protector who has a little bit more juice as a ball screen defender than what I think he gets credit for. I'm trying to think if there are other ones that I like really, truly love. I think Marcus Sasser like ticks a ton of boxes for what Detroit needs. Great point of attack defender. You can play him with Cade. You can play him with Jaden Ivey. You can play him with Asar Thompson. You know, really, really high level shooter. Shot like 46% off the catch last season from three. Just like a bonkers number. Like, he is an awesome, awesome fit, I think, there. Those are probably three of them that stand out. But honestly, I thought that teams this year, Jaime Jaquez is another one in Miami. Like, there's no prospect I've evaluated in the last couple of years who more embodies Heat culture than Jaime Jaquez. Like, it's perfect, right?
One that I wanted to ask you about, in part because I'm sad I didn't get to watch film on him, though I'll get to watch NBA film soon enough, is Leonard Miller. And I was surprised he fell as far as he did. But I also think that Minnesota, considering their wing rotation is a little bit in flux moving forward more than this year, like, if he ends up being a top 20 player from this class, then that is something that's a real lifeline for them.
I think he will be, for what it's worth. I had him ranked 13th. I love the fit with him as like a big, honestly, in this scheme.
As like a four?
Because or even like small ball five occasionally. He won't get to do that in Minnesota as long as Towns and Gobert are there, obviously, and Naz Reid, obviously. But like, you play him in bench units with Naz Reid, that's like the exact guy to, you know, actualize his offensive game, because Naz can really shoot. And then on the other side of it, you have Leonard Miller, who can grab and go and can create as a driver, and who can finish at the rim like at an exceptionally high level as a driver, and is great in transition. Like, all of these things are aspects of the game that Chris Finch is going to be like, yes, like, go. I'm going to empower you to be somebody who, just to be who you are on the basketball court. I'm really, really glad he ended up in Minnesota. I think it's a perfect, perfect, perfect fit for him as a player. And I think it's a perfect fit for him, as a player that needs to come along slowly as well, because I think that you and I are probably in agreement that the Towns Gobert thing, like, probably is not long for Minnesota, maybe. Like, I don't think they both will be there for two more years after, or starting with this one. Like, they're going to have to move off of that at some point, we think, right?
It seems that things are going that direction. It may not be imminent, but at some point in the next 2 years, their salary structure, I did a piece with John Krasinski at The Athletic about this. Like, it's untenable unless they're so good between now and then that the new ownership is willing to pay it.
Right. So, like, to me, I look at Leonard Miller as, like, almost a perfect, you know, a perfect guy who can come in and be valuable in bench units and then eventually become a starter. I think that Leonard's going to be a starter long term. I really do. Part of it is, like, I've sat down with the kid. I've gotten to know him a little bit. Like, he's super, super competitive. He's super intellectually curious. Like, he has the physical tools to be really good. It's hard to find guys that are, you know, 9 foot standing reach, 6 foot 10, 7 foot two wingspan, like, have the tools that he has, have the unique offensive creativity that he has, and then also, like, is humble about, like, where his game is and will want to put in the time and effort to learn. So, yeah, I think it's a home run in terms of the fit with Minnesota, just in terms of scheme, too.
One other question that came to mind, this is going to be off the cuff, but I can't think of – can you think of a team that has a deeper combination of guards whose biggest flaw is shooting than the current Orlando Magic?
No, and that's what makes their draft a bit dumbfounding to me, because when I look at the Magic, I think they have two genuine, like, all-star level players within the next 3 years in Paolo Banchero and Franz Wagner. I am an enormous Franz Wagner fan. Like, I think that dude is going to be, like, seriously, like, an all-star caliber player.
And you know, I'm a big Wendell Carter guy too. Like, I don't think he's a star, yeah, but I think he's a player that will be good for a long time.
Well, and perfectly fits with their core for the next 3 years as well, because of his ability to space it, sharp rim protector for his size, a little bit undersized, obviously, for the NBA center position, at least. Like, there's just so much to be excited about, I think. But to actualize those two players, Franz Wagner and Paolo, you're going to want to put the ball in their hands more. Like, those are the two guys. I want the ball in their hands more than anybody else's. And I'm still in on Jalen Suggs. Like, I still am a believer. I think that what we've seen from him defensively gives him such a high floor in the NBA, especially given that, like, he's not offensively, like, completely toolless, like we saw with, like, Chris Dunn early in his career, right? Like, it was like, okay, Chris Dunn just probably can't play offense at a level commensurate with NBA, necessity. And I think Jalen has more juice there than Chris Dunn does. But Jalen also is going to be like an all defense team member in the backcourt. So if you think he can shoot it long term, he's a guy that's worth keeping around. I am less high on Anthony Black being able to shoot long term. I think he's super valuable, and I think, like, his feel for the game is off the charts, and he is super sharp, and, like, his processing ability is so fast. Like, that dude can really play, but you kind of need him on the ball because I don't buy the shot. So if you're putting him on the ball more often, you are taking reps out of Paolo Banchero and Franz Wagner, which then probably leads to diminishing returns, I think, in terms of being great long term. The other piece of this is Markelle Fultz.
Mm-hmm.
I think Markelle Fultz is actually really good.
Same.
I don't know that people have totally come around to that fact yet. He also isn't a great shooter, but his ability to bend defenses, I think he bends defenses better than Anthony Black does. And thus, you can use him as, like, an off-ball driver a little bit better and more effectively, because if you put the ball in his hands, he might get to the rim. He might be able to navigate bodies in a creative, unique way, and then collapse help defenders in a real way that then allows you to get the defense in rotation and create advantageous circumstances for Paolo Banchero, Franz Wagner, guys like that. So I actually just kind of like Markelle Fultz better than I like Anthony Black, but they're also, like, a bit redundant in terms of having them on the court. So I really like Anthony Black, the player. I don't love the fit here in Orlando much. It's kind of where I'm at, unless they're just going to move Markelle.
If you think that he's the best prospect available, which I did not, but if you feel that way, then you roll those dice even if you like Markelle Fultz a lot. But the problem is, I don't think he is, so you run into it there.
So let's stop on that real quick, because I don't know if I agree, actually, with that. Again, I really like Anthony Black. I had him at like 7 or so. I guess I didn't have him as the best prospect available, but I thought it was a reasonable take. To me, like, if you have guys that are players that you don't necessarily project as all-stars, but probably more as like really high-level starters, I probably would rather take the guy who fits better, which to me in that circumstance, I know it seems strange to say, it was actually Taylor Hendricks that I thought fit best there. And I know that you said you really like Hendricks, and I'll let you kind of explain why in a second, but I actually think that you can play lineups with Wagner, Paulo, Hendricks, Carter all together. Hendricks can space from the corner and be a crazy help defender patrolling the weak side and patrolling the baseline. You have Wendell Carter who can space it a little bit and is a good primary rim protector for his size. But you also have the requisite ball handling out there and play creation that Paulo and Franz allow you. And you just be super big on the court, which probably gives you real positive defensive value as well, given that the only guy I don't love there defensively is Paulo. Like, I think Franz is actually like pretty effective in terms of using his length to cut off angles and do things like that. So I actually love the idea of just drafting Taylor Hendricks and going from there and like continuing to find shooting for Orlando to play next to Paulo and Franz, even though there is theoretically some like positional overlap between those three players.
Yeah, that's it's completely fair. And the other part of it is you draft, then I mean, Sexton Garland is a great example of this, but you draft a good player, and even if you don't play the four, your four best guys, it'll shake out in a different way. That could be that you know, he's your super sub and backs up all those spots, or one of those guys eventually gets hurt or traded or something else. Like, there are a lot of ways that this can resolve. But what intrigued me about Hendricks was some of his base kind of combination of athleticism and shooting just isn't something you see every day. And he applied, like, a lot of the things that I didn't like about his game were things that you could see toned down. And like, it was the best player who's ever gone to UCF, and he's taking these weirdly ambitious shots that don't go in very often. He's not going to be taking those shots in the NBA. But the reactions to get to the rim, both on offense and defense, his jump shot seems completely projectable. And like, I mean, on catch and shoots, the numbers were really, really good. And mechanically, it looks plenty good. And so with Hendricks, I don't see that like MVP upside. Well, congratulations, you're a guy who's taken out of the top five. It's hard to do that. Possible, hard to do. But what I saw in Hendricks was a player who can succeed in the NBA in both one clear way as like this like weak side shot blocker who maybe could defend fives. Like, I think he's better as a four than as a five, but also does enough offensively that he doesn't need to be the guy, and he doesn't take anything away from the guys who are the guy. And that's actually really hard to come by for somebody who has good positional size. Like, it's just that sort of combination of skills. And so it's a weirdly soothing kind of thing from a team building perspective. And it's funny because we just saw John Collins get traded, and John Collins went to the team that drafted Hendricks, and part of the reason I was a little bit frustrated by that was because I wanted to see Hendricks get the opportunity. But in many ways, I like Hendricks. Like, Collins had the skills that he showed at Wake were less relevant to the modern NBA, but he grew into a player who fit, whereas Hendricks is going to start his NBA career as a player who makes sense in the NBA.
Yeah, I think that's all really, really good take. I mean, yeah, no, I agree, like, almost wholeheartedly across the board with that. Like, I think that's really, really smart. And then, like, if you draft Hendricks at 6, the other piece of this in terms of the way the board could have broken for Orlando is if you do want to take a guard then at number 11, you know, there's a chance Cason Wallace was going to be on the board. He went 10th. He'd end up not being there. But, like, Cason Wallace could have been there at 10. Kobe Bufkin could be there at 11. You could draft Cam Whitmore if you really wanted to, like, if you felt okay about that. Like, you would have felt really good that one of, you know, Grady Dick or Jet Howard, I guess. That's a whole other topic in terms of why I didn't love that from Orlando. I loved the fit of, like, getting more shooting. That makes total sense. I just think they took the wrong player on some level. We'll see if it works out. I've been plenty wrong before. But, like, if you really wanted to, you could end up taking a Kobe Bufkin, maybe a Koulibaly if he falls at you know, doesn't go seventh or eighth overall. I think he went eighth, if I remember correctly.
Seventh.
No, he went seventh, if I remember correctly. Grady Dick is there. Like, you're going to get one of your guys to fall to 11, potentially, that could tick the boxes that Anthony Black does in some way, shape, or form as a good defensive player who can also play offense. Like, Kobe Bufkin is the name for me. Like, Kobe Bufkin can play with Markelle Fultz. He can play with Jalen Suggs. He gives you the positional size that you want. Like, his ability to play both on and off the ball is actually an incredible complement to the guards that you already have on the team, whereas Anthony Black, I think, does not complement the guards that are on the team already. He actually, you know, becomes redundant in some way with the guards that are on the team.
Last question I want to ask you, because I know your timing is limited. From what you know right now, does it seem like the 24 draft is on the very weak side?
Yes. At the top, yes. I think there is some depth there that will be interesting to track moving forward. But I do think there is a very real concerning. I think there's a very real concerning amount of upside players in that draft. I really like Ron Holland. I think Ron Holland looks like an awesome high-level starter in the NBA. I have him at number one right now. I think Tyrese Proctor would have gone like 17 or 18 this year if he'd been in the draft. I have him like at fifth right now. Isaiah Collier, somewhat interesting. Stephon Castle, somewhat interesting. But you look at, for instance, like the U19 team, right? They just got beaten by both France and Turkey. And a lot of those guys are eligible for the 2024 NBA draft.
Mm-hmm.
And it's concerning that very few of those guys have stepped up and been guys that like help themselves. Like, a lot of the time you find guys in those tournaments that like really help themselves and put them or are put into a new light, and that just really hasn't happened this year, which is worrisome to me. I would be like Utah. I know, based off of reporting, it seems like they want to have that pick that they owe to, I believe it's Oklahoma City, right?
Mm-hmm.
Transfer this year in the 2024 draft, which is why they're like, you know, re-signing Jordan Clarkson and trying to contend on some level right now for a play-in berth. I think that's super smart. Like, I would not want
to try to knock it out.
Yeah, if I have a pick obligation, I'm trying to knock it out in 2024, baby. Like, let's let's contend, let's compete, let's get this thing going. I think once you get to like 15, 20, it's a normal draft. Like, there are guys that profile as really solid role players. Like, I really am interested in someone like Riley Kugel. I'm interested in somebody like Terrence Arsenault at Houston. You know, some of the guys that withdrew this year, I really like Osoye Ighodaro. I really am interested in Mark Mitchell. I like Izzy Almanza, who you know, played for Overtime Elite last year. I like Alex Saar on some level. There are a number of guys where you can make the case for it, but I'm somewhat concerned, I would say, about the top of that draft. I don't think the top of that draft is one that you want to be involved with.
And that ties in with, to me, and you and I could do a whole separate podcast on our takeaways from free agency and stuff, but, and this is not, I think, the primary reason for most of these teams that this happened, but there are not many franchises that went through this offseason so far with the intention of being bad next year. And I think that's more about the pressure. Yes. Certain general managers, certain organizations felt like Rafael Stone, it isn't about that. For some of these, it's the structural thing with the draft picks they owe and everything else. But it is, yep, really striking that very few teams like are starting the season, you're like, oh, there's no pathway to them being a play-in team. Like, that's now in the West, it might just be that the bar is so high that a lot of teams get knocked out early, kind of like the old school West when it was top eight, where it's just like, well, crap, if it's going to take 50 wins, there's a group of teams that are good but aren't going to win 50. It's not the same with the play-in, but it could be similar. But I mean, the improvements that Houston has intended to make, the improvements that Detroit has intended to make, and a few of these others. And I mean, San Antonio, they haven't had that kind of offseason, except, you know, that they got Victor Wembanyama. And so,
yep,
that element, and then some of the teams that could have improvement in health, like the Hornets and the Pacers, the overtly bad teams aren't that strong. And then the other part of it is like, yeah, even if the top of the draft isn't what you would hope, there will probably be players that are interesting. And part of why the rookie scale in the NBA, even though, you know, for moral reasons, it's a little bit awkward, even if the number three pick doesn't have the same, you know, the EV chart is not the same in this draft as it was previously, well, their contract is not going to be prohibitive anyway. And so if you get a solid rotation player rather than a solid starter, you're not killing your book.
Yeah. No, I think that you're absolutely right about that. I think you're totally right about that. It's also just like, man, 480 is a lot for Dylan Brooks.
True. I mean, I'll end this podcast with the caution that until we see the actual contracts, a lot of these are probably going to end up being more team friendly than we know. Like, if we don't know, make that as an assumption. Maybe there, I don't know anything specifically with Dylan Brooks, but it's a possibility. And sometimes it can be on surprising contracts. And yeah, it's going to be, I'm so excited to see this class more than any other that I've ever scouted. This is the one I'm most excited to see what they look like in summer league, because we're not going to know everything, but we'll get some indications, and we'll have to lean on those until October.
100%. And by the way, we started this podcast making jokes about Brandon Miller in summer league, and I think it might be interesting to kind of close on this. The summer leagues that are important are guys that have not shown anything by the third year and continue to not show anything in summer league within their third year of summer league.
Uh-oh.
have you looked at what happened tonight with the Hornets game? You said you didn't watch it, I guess, right?
Correct. I had other obligations.
Kai Jones, there are some worries here. Kai went for, in 21 minutes tonight, 2 points, 0 rebounds, 0 assists.
But did he have 10 fouls? Because if he didn't have 10 fouls, I'm not interested.
He had 5. Oh, Brandon Miller had 7. We closed in. Like, we're closing in on foul outs in summer league. But, no, like, Kai Jones, the Hornets should be looking to maybe make some decisions on him. James Bouknight, I thought, was like a little bit better than him tonight, but not somebody that was particularly impressive, I would say. Mm-hmm. But Kai Jones, particularly, like, guys like this, when you get into the third year of an NBA, you know, summer league experience, and these guys haven't shown anything in the NBA yet, and they continue to show you who they are in summer league, to me, like, we're veering toward maybe you should not pick up Kai Jones' fourth year option, right? Like, that's, I think those guys, it's important to listen when they tell you who they are at that point. And Brandon Miller looked better in garbage time at the end of this game. Like, let's just be very clear that Brandon Miller is going to be fine. Like, we started with like a big extended bit on how this is bad. I think Brandon's going to be fine. But guys like Kai Jones, guys like James Bouknight, they're the ones you really have to watch, because if they don't perform, that's where the concerns come up.
Yeah, definite possibility. But we'll get more time to see it. And thank you so much for taking the time.
Of course, Danny. Anytime.
Thanks again to Sam Vecenie for taking the time to come on. You can read his excellent work at The Athletic, and including his awesome draft guide, which, if you're a team partisan, you now potentially have more players who are relevant there, but also just to get a sense of who everybody is. It's something I like to consult as a part of my summer league viewing process. You can also check out the Game Theory podcast that he does, which is excellent, and it's both an audio form, and there's a YouTube channel, which you can check out as well, even though being on it on video always stresses me out a little bit. I'm always happy to do it, and he also has many more guests than me who are great and like covers a lot of ground there. I'm so thrilled with how Game Theory has taken off. And if you want to follow Sam on Twitter, you absolutely can, at Sam_Vecenie. That is Sam_Vecenie. Love having him on. If you want to support the show, there are a lot of different ways you can do it. You can subscribe and download every episode in whatever podcast player you're choosing. Real GM Radio is never going to come out on a specific day of the week, so if you pop it in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever, then new episodes will go into your player whenever they're ready, and that is a great way to do it. If we are not in a player that you want to use, let me know, and I can pass it up to people who know how to fix those things, which is, of course, not me. You can also help other people find the show, word of mouth, social media, however you like to do so. And the most important thing for Real GM Radio and any other show that has them is to check out our sponsors. So for us, that is going to FanDuel.com/Boston. You can get up to $200 in bonus bets, and it's baseball season, lots of fun stuff going on. You can also check out my other work, Dunked On and Dunked On Prime, still going strong with Nate. We've broken down pretty much every transaction. We'll catch the rest in the next podcast we do, which will be later in the day on Wednesday. Then, of course, we will do Summer League. We will do off-season grades. Nate does podcasts with somebody who knows each team in depth all 30 teams and plenty of other ground to cover. Can also check out my written work at The Athletic. Have a couple irons in the fire. Also did some collaborative pieces kind of as free agency started and a little bit before with Fred Katz, with John Krasinski, and I think I did one with Kelly Eco too, so that you can check those out. There are some evergreen elements of those, to be sure. And then once the dust really settles on the offseason, I will do some more stuff. Like, one of the things I've been waiting on is to actually do 2024 space projections, because now we have the general structure of the cap, tax, and exceptions moving forward due to the new CBA. But getting the contract structures is the thing that I'm waiting on. So that will be, I'm guessing that'll be next week, just because it takes some time for the actual data to come out there, the terms and everything like that, which is always a fun one for us cap nerds. And you can also listen to the recent episodes of this pod and everything else. If you have any feedback, good, bad, or indifferent, DannyLarueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. That is an absolute promise. Not always the greatest at replying, but that's not what I promise. So I will read it though. And I really do appreciate it. And it could be, you know, I get lots of types of stuff. It could be guest suggestions. It could be, hey, an additional note or something else like that. But I really do appreciate it. And that is all for now. So thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.